4. Jerry, Jerry, and me. Morningside Golf Club of Southern California, mid-1990s, I was standing on a beautiful green. Can't recall which one, but it doesn't really matter. It's a beautiful course no matter where you look. There are plenty of palms and other majestic trees all over the place, and majestic mountains surrounding you with more blue mountains beyond. It's just gorgeous. But at the moment, I don't give a shit about any of that. Sorry, Jack. Nicholas, the course designer and my pal. Right now, I'm doubled over laughing my head off like a fool while a former president of the United States is stomping up and down, throwing the dirtiest word in the English language around in every direction. His face is crimson. He's mad as hell, angrier than I'd ever seen him. But even in that unguarded moment, he was one of the finest men I ever had the privilege to know. Another scene, southwestern Ohio, mid-1960s. The grass is just as green and perfectly cut as the grass at Morningside. But it's a different kind of grass. And this time, there are big white lines drawn across every 10 yards. Oh, and there are a couple thousand people on either side of me screaming their heads off, because some of them love me and some of them hate me. It's not even me they love or hate. It's just the colors and the logo and the damn uniform I have on. And lined up across from me are some of the biggest, ugliest bastards I've ever seen, waiting to stomp my head into the ground just for fun. Up there on the scoreboard next to my team's name, there's a big fat goose egg. And as for the other guys, well, let's just say they're already well into the dozens. But over on the sidelines, there's a guy wearing my team jacket, arms folded across his chest, staring right at me with hard eyes. He expects the absolute best from me, no matter how beat up I feel or how bad things look. I know if I screw this up, he's going to rip me a new one later. But even then, even though he scares the living hell out of me, he's one of the finest men I've ever had the privilege to know. If you'll permit me, I want to take a break from the weird and wild tales of Washington to tell you about a couple of genuine American heroes. Maybe it's no coincidence that they both hailed from the middle of America or that they played the same sport. It surely is a coincidence that their names both are Jerry, although one is spelled with a G. Both of them were great leaders of men. Well, one led women and children, too. One had a few more followers than the other. They both found their way to glory in very different ways, even if they had to put up with a lot of crap along the way. And I was lucky enough to learn from both. There are a number of people who helped raise me up in my life. Deb still does to this day, and so do Lindsay and Tricia. Of course, there were my parents and my brothers and sisters and friends I've had for decades. But two guys in particular loom large in my life as inspirations and examples for the leadership I carried with me all the way to the Speaker's office. Frankly, I think we'd all be better off as a country if we focused more on people like Jerry Faust and Jerry Ford, two legends in their respective fields. But more than that, two decent men who had a lasting impact on me and a lot of other people. I've had to deal with a lot of crazy shit, more than I ever thought I'd signed up for. When it really got bad, I'd pray, and then probably, with a little nudge from the man upstairs, I'd remember the example of these two guys. Knowing them and learning from them gave me a grounding that helped me get through a lot of different messes. The story begins in a darkened classroom, where the only light came from a flickering screen at the front of the room. It was a short film about a brand new local high school, Archbishop Muller, that had only opened a few years earlier and was looking to recruit kids to join its newest class. Once the movie part was over, they turned the lights back on, and I blinked a bit as my eyes got adjusted, as did the rest of my fellow Saints Peter and Paul Junior High School 8th graders. This was already a banner day at the school, and it was only going to get better. A big, tall guy with broad shoulders and a crew cut strode with heavy footsteps around the back of the room, up to the front, and turned around and asked if we had any questions. He had introduced himself at the beginning of the session. But to most of us, he needed no introduction. This was Jerry Faust, Muller's head football coach, here to talk to us junior high guys in person. This beat the hell out of algebra class any day. Faust was already a football legend in our part of Ohio. His father had coached at Chaminade High School in Dayton, just one county over. Jerry played under him there before going on to be a star quarterback at the University of Dayton. He graduated in 1958 and 4 years later signed on to be the first head coach of Muller, which had opened in 1960. There, he became one of the most successful high school coaches in the country. At Muller, he put up a total record of 178 wins, 23 losses, with 7 unbeaten seasons. He later went on to be the head coach at Notre Dame, where his record wasn't as good, but at Muller, his legacy was, and still is, secure. All of the Catholic high schools in that part of the Cincinnati area drew from different parishes. Before Muller was built, the Catholic kids from the area would have gone to either Purcell High or Roger Bacon High. I would have ended up going to one of those myself. But when Jerry Fouth came to coach at Muller, that changed the game. Every elementary and middle school kid playing football wanted to make it to the big leagues and play for this real live local hero. I've been playing football since I was a little kid, mostly defense, but I learned to become a pretty good long snapper too. Before Faust had even begun his presentation, I was already sold. So I don't remember paying that close of attention when he talked about everything the school had to offer, the academics, the brand new facilities, and all of that. I'm sure it was nice, but come on, that's not what I gave a hoot about. He mentioned something about becoming men of Muller. It was an all-boys high school, but I wasn't listening that closely. I just couldn't wait to lace up my cleats and show Coach Faust what I could do. Imagine how it felt then, after Faust finished his talk and started to walk down the rows of desks, when he stopped at mine and put his hand on my shoulder. His big, broad hand, a quarterback's hand, all right, and just rested there for a second. I froze. He looked me right in the eye, man to man, and said, "I sure hope you're going to come. We're looking forward to having you on the team." I'd never met Faust, definitely had never spoken to him. Why he decided to stop at my desk, I still have no idea. Maybe I just looked like a beefy kid who probably played football. But however it happened, it was the highlight of my life up to that point. I was pumped up and ready to hit the Muller field right then and there. It was only later that I realized how much I would learn from Jerry Faust that had nothing to do with football, and what becoming a man of Muller really meant. Playing for Coach Faust was exactly the kind of experience that would bring a group of guys together. At first, we were united in fear. Faust was tough. His dad had been even tougher. He used to carry around a leather strap to whack his players, his own son included, when they screwed up. That wasn't Jerry Faust style. He got mad, sure, but I never once heard him use a four-letter word. He sure knew how to make himself understood, though. He'd get right in your face, grab hold of your face mask, and shake your head when he really wanted to get a point across. But you didn't have to play for him long to realize that he was just as fair as he was tough. He knew how to inspire us and motivate us to be the best we could be. When you did something right, he let you know it. When you screwed up, he let you know it too. One practice, I got a great block on Jerry Malk, another Jerry, I know, a senior linebacker whose family owned the jewelry store across the street from Andy's Cafe. He and I got along fine, and our families were friends, but I was lined up against Jerry, and I had my own job to do. Coach Val saw my block and came over to us after the whistle blew. "Nice work, Boehner," he said, and I felt like I was on cloud nine. Then he turned to Jerry. "Get off my field." Poor Jerry had to go run laps for letting a reserve guy like me get the best of him. But once he got back on the line for the rest of the practice, Jerry made sure to lay my ass out every chance he got. 2 years later, I ended up on the other end of that stick. I was a senior pulling guard, and one practice was lined up against a sophomore defensive end who I guess hadn't hit his growth spurt yet. He was a small guy. I felt bad for him. When I went to block him, I'd hold him at arm's length to take it easy on him. Faust saw me, blew the whistle, came right over and ripped me a new one. He got right in my face and reminded me that I had one job to do, and that was to block, period. If I wouldn't take it easy on the other guy in the game, I'm damn sure shouldn't do it in practice. Then he stepped back and hollered, "I want to run that play again." And turning right straight toward me, he said, "And Boehner, you're going to block that guy." The next play, I floored that poor little sophomore flat on his back. "Now that's more like it," Coach said. Fowle's sense of humor would pop up in the most unexpected places. One day in my sophomore year, when I was walking down the hall on my way to class, and from somewhere behind me, I heard this voice, "Hey, Beaner!" I turned around, hopefully thinking maybe he was going to tell me that I was getting called up to play in that week's game. Nope. "Beaner," he asked, "why do you have a wallet in each back pocket?" Well, I didn't have a clue what he meant. I hadn't put one wallet in my back pocket, let alone in both. Then it dawned on me Coach Fowle was making fun of me for having a big butt. Great. He walked away, chuckling down the hall. Nowadays, I guess people would make some big deal about body shaming, but I just laughed it off, although I clearly never forgot it. From that day forward, I've never carried a wallet in my back pocket. Not once. A couple of jokes thrown your way were just part of the deal. Nothing could make me disloyal to Jerry Faust. When my junior year came along and I was looking at a spot on the varsity football team, I ended up having to make a tough choice. I played basketball my first 2 years at Muller, and my junior season was about to start. A lot of the guys on the football team played other sports as conditioning. Jerry Van ran track and was one of the best runners in the school. I had a lot of fun playing basketball, and our coach, Jerry Durger, was a fine man. Yet, another great Jerry in my life. It's a common name in our part of the world. Okay, Durger coached high school basketball well into his 80s, and his famous Durger defense was known to generations of Cincinnati area athletes. One day I was walking down a hallway to class, I heard what sounded like an argument around the corner. As I got a little closer, I realized it was Durger and Faust arguing back and forth about some kid. Uh-oh, I thought. I'd hate to be in that poor sucker's tennis shoes. Well, I pulled up short when I heard them mention my name. Faust wanted me off the basketball team so I could spend more time in the weight room. Muller was one of the first high school football programs in the country to have a weight training program. And boy, it was state-of-the-art. One of the assistant coaches ran it out of his basement. Faust thought I could really make a difference on the varsity football team if I focused on that and got my strength up. But Durger was telling Faust to back off. He wanted to keep me on the basketball team. For me, it was not a hard decision to make. I was closer to Faust and trusted his judgment. So I quit basketball that year and hit the weight room. I was going to stick with football for the next 2 years. And my 2 years playing varsity for Jerry Faust were two of the most meaningful years of my young life. That's not to say I was some football superstar. Far from it. I wasn't even guaranteed to make the varsity team as a junior. We all had to try out again, and Faust made it clear that you wouldn't make varsity unless you were willing to put in the work. He had no time for slackers. For me, that meant sweating it out in the weight room when I would rather have been playing basketball. But I made the varsity team, and that made it all worth it. Being a starter was a totally different ballgame, literally. Everything changes when you're out there in the middle of the field and the stands are full of your family and friends all looking down at you, hoping you don't screw up. I just tried to do the best I could, which, in sports, politics, and pretty much everything else, is easier said than done. I played linebacker or pulling guard most of the time, but somehow my long snapper skills from back in junior high had stuck with me, so I played that position too. That meant I was on the field a fair amount, which meant more chances to screw things up. In one game against Newport Catholic, we were set up to punt, and I was in position, ready to snap the ball to the kicker. As we lined up at the line of scrimmage, I had noticed the linebacker across from me was a giant. That was bad enough. But as I got over the ball, in the few seconds before the play was called, I made the mistake of looking into this guy's face. Even through the face mask, I could tell he was just about the ugliest son of a bitch I'd ever seen in my young life, and he was looking right at me. Right before the snap was called, and I'll never forget this sound as long as I live, he looked at me and growled. He let out this low, guttural sound that basically said, "I'm going to eat you alive." Well, that scared the living hell out of me, and I let off a bad snap that sent the ball flying over the kicker's head. After that, my fear of the ugly linebacker was replaced by a much more immediate fear, getting reamed out by Coach Faust for flubbing the snap. There was one time when I decided I just couldn't face Faust's temper at all. It was my junior year. We'd just been handed a pretty bad loss by Princeton High School in Cincinnati. We didn't lose often during my 2 years on the varsity, but when we did, we knew there was going to be hell to pay at the team meeting the next morning. When I woke up that Saturday morning, I decided I just wasn't going. Wasn't even getting out of bed. After the gut-wrenching loss the night before, I just couldn't take reliving it with Coach, with an extra helping of anger thrown in at the practice afterward, so I stayed under the covers. My mother was not having it. She came into the room with all the bunk beds I shared with my brothers, all empty except for me, firmly planted in mine. "Get out of that bed, John," she said. "You made a commitment to that team, and you better be there with them when they take the heat." I didn't care. If it meant I had to quit, fine. I was not going to face Coach Faust that morning. Then the phone rang out in the hall. Mom went to answer it. "Yes, he's here," I heard her say. Then there was a pause. "Don't worry, he's coming. He's just running a little late, but he'll be there." She almost had to drag me out of bed, but sure enough, I made it. Coach made me run extra laps for being late, so in the end, I missed the worst parts of the rehashing of Friday night's game after all. But that was the last time I ever thought about quitting. Although, something happened my senior year that did make me wonder if my high school football career would end early. Our arch rival was Roger Bacon High School, and we hated those guys. That year, we knew the game against them was going to be a bruiser. Their coach, Bron Basevich, had put together a top-notch team, and our work was cut out for us. We had an intense practice schedule set up for the whole week leading up to Friday's game. On Monday, Coach Faust showed up with a cooler full of some special kind of drink. It was supposed to help give us energy, he said. It wasn't on the market yet. It was some sort of magic formula that had been cooked up at the University of Florida. He called it Gatorade. Nobody in the team had ever heard of it before, and I still don't know how he got a hold of it, but for that week, we fueled up on Gatorade, hoping we'd be able to practice that much harder and really hand it to Roger Bacon. Friday came. We were playing part of a doubleheader matchup of Catholic high schools held at Xavier University Stadium. Playing in a college stadium was a huge deal. In the opening game that afternoon, LaSalle beat McNicholas. Muller versus Roger Bacon was the marquee bout. In the end, the secret Florida formula didn't help us much. We lost 45-0, still the worst defeat in Muller history, and I ended up getting carried off the field. I'd gone for a block, and the next thing I knew, I was on my back and couldn't move. On the sidelines, the team doctor, who was an osteopath and didn't seem to always have his shit together, poked around and said everything seemed fine. My back spasms disagreed with him. I'd had some back issues before, going back to the age of 15, when I'd wrenched something lifting a crate of pickles at Andy's Cafe. I got checked out at a hospital where they found no permanent damage, but my back really has never been the same since. I returned to practice a few days later, and I played through the rest of the season, even when my back flared up. The way I saw it, it was my final season. I'd been with the team all 4 years, and there was no way I was going to miss the last couple of games because of a backache. Besides, by that point, I knew that I probably wasn't going to make it as a football player in college. But I'd been playing most of my life, and I wanted to enjoy the game as much as I could before I hung up my cleats for good. It was a good thing that I hadn't concentrated only on football in school. There were actual classes I had to attend, and after all, I had to do something in the offseason, right? But in academics, like athletics, I wasn't the worst, but I sure wasn't the best either. I never got a D or F in my life, but I didn't get many A's or B's either. Jerry Faust was my teacher as well as my coach. He taught typing. A bunch of us signed up because we figured Coach liked us and we'd have an easy time passing the class. We thought we were pretty slick, as so many teenagers do. We should have known that he would be just as demanding in the classroom as he was on the field. He made us attack those typewriters like they were Roger Bacon linemen. He worked our fingers sore just as he worked our legs sore in practice. Somehow I passed, but I'm still not very good at typing. Of course, faith was a big part of what brought the Muller community together. Praying and going to Mass had been a big part of my life for as long as I could remember. My family went to Saints Peter and Paul Church for Mass together every Sunday. In grade school, we had Mass every day before school started. At Muller, which was run by the Marinus Priest and Brothers, it was only once a week. But if you were on Jerry Faust's football team, you never forgot who was really in charge. We said Hail Marys before and after every practice. On game day Fridays, we said more prayers than I thought anyone knew. We prayed that morning, we prayed together at lunch, and in the afternoon there was a special mass before we got ready for the game. If it was an away game, we prayed on the bus. We prayed on the sidelines before the game. We prayed at halftime. We prayed after the game, whether we won or lost. I said more Hail Marys in high school than at any other point in my life, and I still say some every day. Remembering that God has a plan, that it was bigger than you and bigger than a football game, was important. Years later, I would remind myself that God had a plan. It was bigger than any house bill or blown-up White House negotiation. And it definitely helped to keep that 45-0 loss in perspective. Going to Muller also showed me there was a much bigger world out there than the little corner of Reading, Ohio, where I grew up. Most of my life up until then had been spent between my parents' house, my grandparents' house, Andy's Cafe, church, and small parish schools where I knew almost everybody. At Muller, I met a whole bunch of different kinds of people from all over. Some kids dressed to the nines every day. And I realized for the first time that although my family wasn't poor by any means, we didn't have nearly as much money as a lot of folks in our area. But I also learned how little that really mattered. What mattered was how hard you worked and how you treated everybody. It was these kinds of lessons that helped set me straight before going out into the wider world, and some of the most important ones I learned from Jerry Faust. He taught me to never quit, that the absolute only way to get what you want is by putting in the work day after day. The simple phrase, never give up, might sound corny, but I'll tell you, when you're in a giant college stadium getting blasted by your rival school in front of everyone you know, and that scoreboard is ticking up to 45-0, it's pretty tempting to want to give up. And if you hurt your back during that mess of a game, who in their right mind would go back? Why not sit the rest of the season out? Coach wouldn't have it. It was that simple. And most of us would do anything we could not to disappoint Coach Faust. More than a coach, he was a teacher, a mentor, a father figure to everyone who ever played for him. He did more than teach us how to run this play or that one and yell at us when we screwed up. He taught us what it meant to be men of Muller, to know what was required of us to become men and become leaders, and to do the right thing no matter what. Coach Faust loved coaching at Muller. He once said he'd only leave the job under one circumstance, if he was ever asked to become the head coach at his beloved University of Notre Dame. As it turned out, he was asked to do just that. It was unusual, to say the least, for any college program to hire a head coach from a high school team who had no experience on the collegiate level. In most cases, a coach like Jerry Faust would be brought in at a secondary post, like an offensive coordinator. And it was unheard of for a program like Notre Dame to take a gamble like this. Coach Faust had to have felt the risk, too. He would be giving up his incredible record at the high school level to take a shot at one of the most watched football programs in the country. What if he blew it? But the idea of walking in the same footsteps as legends like Newt Rockne was irresistible to him. So he headed off to South Bend to take the field with the Fighting Irish for the 1981 season. Unfortunately, his record at Notre Dame was nowhere close to what it was at Muller. Still, Faust treated every day spent there as an honor and left a mark of good sportsmanship and integrity on every player he met. And he had a view of life that I try to copy during all my time in Congress. No matter the setbacks, he felt honored and lucky that the good Lord had given him a chance at this dream. After all, most people don't even make it that far, and he knew he gave it his all. When he stepped down in 1985, he said, I only had 26 miserable days at Notre Dame. That's when we lost. Other than that, I was the happiest guy in the world, and I knew what he meant. So those 26 game days were rough, but all the practices, all the time spent getting to know and work with fine young men on a campus where the Catholic faith runs strong, those days were good for his soul. And anyone who played for him will tell you that learning from him was good for theirs too. There was another guy I came to know much later who also knew a thing or two about what was good for the soul. He stepped in to clear away one of the biggest shitstorms this country has ever seen, and in doing so, helped to heal the soul of our nation. He'd never let anyone say that kind of thing about him when he was alive, because that's just how modest he was. But now that he's dead, I'll say it as loud as I want, and I don't care who hears it. This was President Gerald R. Jerry Ford. When I first met him, I thought I was being set up for a presidential-sized smack on the wrist. At the time, I was a freshman congressman who liked to spend time throwing bombs at his party's leadership. So then I got invited by the leader of my party to go out and play golf with one of the greatest institutionalists the House had ever known. It was 1992 when Bob Michael of Illinois, the leader of the Republicans in Congress, asked me to come to the Jerry Ford Invitational, a pro-am golf tournament the former President Ford held in Vail, Colorado, every August since he left politics in 1977. I didn't know what Michael was up to. There had to be some sort of catch. Clearly, I was in trouble for something. I had spent my first term making a few friends and a lot of enemies, kicking over rocks like the House Bank and the House Post Office that had been enriching members of Congress by costing the taxpayers dearly. Needless to say, this upset the leadership of both parties. Democrat Speaker Tom Foley and Michael was the top Republican, and because I was in Michael's party, it was his job to try to deal with me. To be frank, that was a pain in the ass. But somehow, I still kept up a good personal relationship with Bob and his chief of staff, Billy Pitts, always making sure to give them a heads up when I was up to something with my young hotshot buddies. After all, it doesn't cost anything to be nice. Bob was a golfer himself, and he liked that I was. That was something we had in common, at least. He had been in Congress since 1957 and served alongside Gerald Ford in the House for many years. Even though he went on to serve in higher office, Ford's true love in politics was the House of Representatives. He knew the institution inside out. As we got to become closer friends later, I learned how deep that love went. Maybe Bob Michael thought it would be good for this hot-headed freshman to meet the grand old institutionalist. So he asked me to come out to the tournament after we finished nominating President George Herbert Walker Bush to run for re-election at the Republican National Convention in Houston. And, of course, I accepted. That's when I first met Jerry Ford. President Gerald Ford is not a name that most people think of these days when considering great Republican presidents. That's not really his fault. Ford's problem was that he was surrounded by two men who were both very prominent for different reasons, Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan. He also narrowly lost his own election to the presidency to Jimmy Carter in 1976. But none of that changes the fact that Ford was an important leader in the 20th century. He took over after Nixon resigned in disgrace, and his integrity and decency were essential to restoring public trust in public officials. Prior to his time in the White House, he was a leader in the U.S. Congress and had worked to reform the House in his own day. There were very few people in the world who counted Ford as an enemy. Even Carter, his one-time bitter political rival, eulogized him when he died. I had the great privilege of calling Jerry Ford a friend. Over the years, I had glimpses of the real Jerry Ford in the sport that truly shows people who they are: golf. After Ford died, a local newspaper said his drive was as straight as his character and true as his word. Yeah, right. As a man, Ford was certainly always straight and true, but the same could not always be said for his swing. Though he got a bad rap over the years as some kind of klutz, as president, he once fell down a flight of steps. He was a fine athlete, a former football star at the University of Michigan. But golf was a different matter. He loved the sport mostly as a reason to hang around with his friends and have a good time. But he was not a natural golfer. When he was vice president, he once sent a golf ball flying so far off target that it hit a bystander in the head, sending the guy to the hospital. On the same day, another ball pounded an unsuspecting golf cart that was carrying a policeman. Golf legend Arnold Palmer used to joke that Ford's kamikaze golf balls just barely missed him on more than one occasion. The famed comedian Bob Hope, an old friend and golfing partner of the president, used to say, "It's not hard to find Jerry Ford on the golf course. just follow the wounded. There was a great group of current and former members of Congress, lobbyists, professional golfers, and other celebrities, most of whom I barely knew, who showed up for these Jerry Ford invitationals, and everybody had a hell of a time. Days on the golf course were followed by nights with good food and good wine. And you can still smoke pretty much everywhere. In fact, I became especially good friends with a former Ford military aide who had gone on to work for U.S. Tobacco. Given my long-term acquaintance with their product, I figured he'd be a good guy to know. I had so much fun on my first visit that I made a point to come back every year. I once played in a foursome with country music star Vince Gill, who, in case you wondered how clueless about pop culture I was, and still am, I had never heard of, let alone met. He was mobbed on the golf course. Everybody wanted his autograph. They hardly seemed to care about Ford, the man who rescued the country after Watergate. It says something a little disturbing about the country, especially our education system, when people recognize a singer more than a president. But Ford being Ford, he took it all in stride. The last year of the tournament was held in 1996. Ford wanted to make that one special. And for me, it truly was. That year, I had brought along one of my longtime friends from my hometown, Al Buzmeyer. It seemed like the whole town of Vail had turned out for the last ever Jerry Ford Invitational. There were huge ads taken out in the local paper telling everyone to come out to the Vail Golf Club. And the people showed up in a big way. There were crowds all over the course. Ford was in demand everywhere. So it was totally understandable that he didn't have time for everyone. Yet, somehow, he seemed to. In the middle of the circus, on the first day, Buzz and I ended up in the same foursome with President Ford. Ford had never met Buzz, who was just a regular guy from Ohio, and was in awe of all the big-name celebrities all around. About halfway through the course, out of nowhere, Ford said, "Hey, Buzz, come over here and read this putt for me." And without batting an eye, up stepped Buzz. He gave Ford his 2 cents, and the former president sank the putt. After that, Buzz ended up basically being Ford's caddy for the next 3.5 days. Ford would barely take a swing, especially not a putt, without getting Buzz's advice. Buzz, of course, was eating all this up. A former president of the United States needed his advice to play golf on a world-class course. I got a little choked up at the idea of me and my buddy being lucky enough to be yucking it up with a former president who treated us like we'd been friends for years. On the very last day of the tournament, the crowds really turned out. We came around a corner on the 18th hole, and there must have been 10,000 people gathered around. That was a lot of pressure. But I kept my head down and played it out. After everyone was finished, Ford and his wife, Betty, took photos with everybody. And when my turn came, he looked around and said, "Where's Buzz?" So the former president told the photographers to wait, and in front of 10,000 people found Buzmeyer and brought him out of the crowd, plucked him right between Betty and himself. Everyone around us had no idea who this guy was. But Ford had gone out of his way to make Buzz feel welcome, even though he wasn't one of the big shots at the tournament. That's what I mean about golf showing you who people really are. That evening, there was a concert at a local outdoor theater to close out the festivities. The guest of honor was the entertainment legend himself, Bob Hope. For readers under a certain age, the name Bob Hope probably doesn't mean as much to you as it does to the rest of us. But trust me, he was entertainment royalty. A natural comedian and jokester, he had a catalog of one-liners, like, "You know you're getting old when the candles cost more than the cake." In addition to being a staple of American stage and screen, big and small, for decades, and a friend to the troops through his numerous USO tours, Hope had known every president going back to Franklin Roosevelt. Of all the presidents, Hope recalled, "Ford was the one I call a pal." The two pals spent a lot of time playing golf, leading Hope to joke that apparently the Betty Ford Center can cure anything except Jerry's slice. Hope, of course, showed up for his friend's final last golf tournament. He was 93 years old. I saw him during the first few days of the event being wheeled around in a golf cart. Old age had gotten a hold of him, and the guy I'd seen on TV or in the movies for decades wasn't the same person in front of me. That was a sobering encounter, especially since I can say with some certainty that I was not totally sober at the time. He didn't quite look like he had everything together. His eyes were bloodshot, and he seemed to be looking around blankly. This was a guy who once shot out jokes on the spot, like a machine gun. Now he looked like he didn't even know where he was. When he took the stage in Vail, nobody was sure of what to expect. I felt a little bit bad about it, but the joke was on me. Bob Hope stole the show. When he took center stage, it was like a switch flipped, and a light turned on in the guy. He had some sort of assistant up there with him who would whisper in his ear to remind him of his cues, and Hope would poke fun at the guy and make him part of the act. He was funny on his own, but the way he played off the other guy really got people rolling, and he brought the house down. When Hope's act was finished, Jerry Ford took the stage again to say a final thank you and good night. As part of that, he asked a bunch of his friends by name to join him on the stage. He called my name, and up I went. Next thing I knew, I was standing next to Bob Hope. We all waved to the crowd for a minute or two, and when it was over, Hope hooked his arm under mine, and we walked off the stage together. As far as I know, that was the last live performance Bob Hope ever gave. And the last time he ever walked off a stage after a show was with me. This was a man who'd been on television longer than I'd been alive, who'd met presidents, royalty, war heroes, and every movie star of the last few decades, who traveled the road to everywhere with Bing Crosby, and here he was, walking off the stage with me. The following November, Bob Hope's last ever television special aired. Fittingly, it was called Laughing with the Presidents. And the Fords, along with the Clintons and the Bushes, made a guest appearance. In 2003, he died at the ripe old age of 100. And I suppose it's clear by now, Jerry Ford and I got along right away and became fast friends. He was a warm, easygoing guy, from the Midwest like me, a man of the House like I was too. He was first elected to Congress in 1948 and served in the House for more than 20 years before he was called up to be Vice President and then President. He hadn't looked for an advancement like that. He was just doing his job. And we needed him to help bring much-needed stability to the country after all the Watergate mess. But as I got to know him, it was pretty clear to me that Ford felt his jump to the executive branch was a wrong turn on what he'd hoped for years was a road to the speakership. It was after that final Ford Invitational that I got to play with another leader who was about as different from Ford as anyone could be. Getting to know these two men at around the same time made for quite the contrast, and I tried to learn what I could from that. I'd gotten to know Bill Clinton fairly well since the Republicans took back the House majority in 1994, and I joined the leadership team as conference chairman in 1995. Clinton was an avid golfer, of course, but we'd never played together. After the last Ford tournament, my wife and I and a couple of friends got in an RV and drove out from Vail, Colorado, to Jackson Hole, Wyoming. We pulled into Jackson Hole, and first thing we noticed was an abundance of reporters, and it turned out President Clinton was in town. Shit, I thought, this is not where we wanted to be. Just a few weeks before, I'd been at the GOP convention in San Diego, where we nominated Senator Bob Dole to try to unseat Clinton after one term. Earlier that summer, I'd played a role in Dole's search for a running mate, in what had to be one of the most bizarre projects of my entire political career. In June of 1996, as Republicans were trying to figure out how to give Bob Dole the boost he needed to beat Bill Clinton in the fall, my chief of staff, Barry Jackson, came to me with what he said was some big news. He'd been talking with some other staffers and people he knew around town, and they'd done a ton of research, and apparently they'd come up with a dynamite pick to be Bob Dole's running mate. Of course, I wanted Dole to win, so I was all ears. I met with the team, and they gave me the name, Antonin Scalia, who had been sitting on the Supreme Court since Ronald Reagan appointed him in 1986. Well, this isn't who I expected, but the more I thought about it, the more it made sense. He was not only a brilliant jurist, but the son of an immigrant and the patriarch of a large Catholic family himself. He also had a blunt way of speaking that made the poor fool he was up against feel like he'd been hit by a 2x4. I liked Bob Dole, but he wasn't Mr. Charisma. Scalia would be the perfect guy to send to the Knights of Columbus Hall or the VFW. So now it was my job to see if he had any interest whatsoever in making the leap from law into electoral politics. I didn't know Justice Scalia at all, but I cold-called his office, and he accepted my invitation to lunch. Jackson and I met him at AV's Ristorante, a classic Italian place on New York Avenue that is now, unfortunately, long gone. The older women who ran the place escorted us into the back room, which wasn't open at lunch, but there was Scalia sitting at a table by himself in the middle of the room, a bottle of wine and a glass in front of him, and we introduced ourselves, and I called him Mr. Justice. "Nino," he said immediately. "Call me Nino." That put us at ease right away. I didn't feel like beating around the bush. "I want to ask you a favor," I said. "And do you think you could avoid telling me no until lunch is over?" He agreed to this condition. And then we looked at our menus. As it turned out, all of us had a fondness for pizza with anchovies. Things were going pretty well. When I brought up the idea of him joining the Dole ticket, he looked at me like I was crazy. He was concerned about how his leaving could affect the Supreme Court, as well as the federal pension he could risk losing if he left his seat. He had 9 kids to support, after all. I reminded him that there would be plenty of Washington law firms ready to hire a former justice for an of-counsel position no matter how the election went. Well, he was intrigued and asked for the weekend to think it over. And true to his word, he called me the next week and told me he had his response ready. "You're not a lawyer," he said, "so you need to write this down exactly as I say it." And he dictated to me what turned out to be the same phrase Chief Justice Charles Evans Hughes once used in a similar situation. "The possibility is too remote to comment upon, given my position." This was a classic Washington move, the non-denial. Well, that was pretty exciting. I'd only been in Congress a few years, and here I was helping to pick the next vice president. We'd sealed the deal over pepperoni and anchovy pizza, but we weren't quite done yet. There was still someone else we had to talk to about it, Bob Dole. Nobody had wanted to bring it up to him until we talked with Scalia. He had been on the road campaigning anyway. As soon as he got back to Washington, Jackson and I rushed over to see him. His first reaction when we told him was in typical dour Dole fashion, reflexively negative. "Scalia's not going to do this. He's on the court." "Bob," I said, "I took it upon myself to have lunch with him." Now Dole's eyebrows arched a bit. He was intrigued. I walked him through our conversation and then triumphantly handed him the note where I'd written Scalia's response. "Well, this means yes," he said. Yes, at least he was interested. So we left Dole with his new running mate all teed up. "If you need me to do anything else," I told him, "just let me know." I headed out of there like a conquering hero, a real player, at least in my own mind, and I never heard anything about it again. Never knew what the hell happened. Dole picked his old political rival Jack Kemp as his running mate and went down to a big defeat against Bill Clinton. Oh, well, Scalia probably would have been a fine vice president, but all in all, America was damn lucky he ended up staying right where he was for as long as he did. We got to be friends out of it, enjoying anchovies together and many other forms over the years. So maybe my VP plan didn't work out, but I was still set to campaign full bore against Clinton all the way up to the election in November. And I needed this golfing vacation to relax me a bit before the tough fights ahead. So you can imagine how I felt when I answered the phone in the house we'd rented in Jackson Hole, only to hear a voice identify itself as a member of the White House staff. "The president would like to invite you to play golf with him tomorrow," they said. How in the hell did he even know I was here? I thought. I had to find some way out of it. "Well," I said, "I'm supposed to go fishing tomorrow. How about the next day?" There was a short pause. "Congressman," the voice said, emphasizing the word. The President of the United States, carefully pronouncing each word in the full title, would like to invite you to play golf tomorrow. Oh, I got the message. Okay, I'll be there. So the next day I watched, jealous, as Deb and our friends headed off for a day of rafting and fishing on the Snake River. Our tea time had been pushed back because of something much more pressing. A bombing in the Balkans required the President's attention, and there wasn't much I could do about that. But eventually, we met up and teed off. Clinton's close friend and advisor, Vernon Jordan, was with us as well. Bill Clinton was a guy who liked to have a good time, sometimes too good a time, but he kept pretty focused on the golf course. All in all, it was a pretty normal game, and Clinton played decently. As we finished on the 18th hole, I saw Deb and the other two couples standing behind the rope waving to me. To this day, I'm not sure how they got themselves in, but somehow they did. I also saw a bank of photographers and TV cameras getting ready to take pictures of the president coming off the golf course with me, a member of the House Republican leadership who was supposed to be making his life harder. Damn it. There's no way of getting out of this one. I was trapped. Of course, I had to take Clinton over to introduce him to my wife and our friends, and because he's a talker, we all stood around chatting for several minutes. And of course, the TV news all over the country aired footage of Clinton yucking it up on the golf course with Boehner, the House Republican Conference Chairman. I got a lot of calls from friends the next day harassing the crap out of me for spending so much time with my new liberal best friend. There wasn't a big golfing scene in Hope, Arkansas. But Bill Clinton set out to get good at the game because he figured it would help ease his way into the ranks of the political elite to which he aspired from an early age. Well, he certainly made it to the top rung of the ladder, and he got pretty good at golf along the way. But he didn't always strictly come by it honestly. He wasn't afraid to call a mulligan or two, which became known as a billigan in an outing. So there was a slightly shady side of his game, too. This wasn't exactly a surprise given the phrase whiff of scandal that became attached to the Clintons over time. And maybe, knowing the guy, it wasn't exactly a surprise he usually got away with it, too. Even after the Ford Invitational formally ended, Jerry Ford and I met up to play golf several times near his home in California. One of those later trips, about 1999, I saw the funniest thing I ever saw on a golf course. Ford went down in history as the all-American suburban dad, calm, mild-mannered, maybe a little clumsy, who wound up in the White House with his pipe and a sweater. And while it's true that he was always a perfect gentleman in public, he was also an ex-Navy man, and he knew how to swear like any old sailor. That was a side of him that came out occasionally. And on the golf course, he wasn't always a saint. One day at Morningside, I was playing with the 86-year-old former president, and we found ourselves on a par 5 with a fair amount of water hazards. On the second shot, Ford hit the ball over the water and did the same with his third shot. Now we were onto the fairway, and Ford had hit the short ball. On his fourth shot, he hit the ball straight into the water. He was not happy, but he dropped a new ball, and he hit that ball right into the water, too. He was getting visibly upset. He dropped a third ball, and damned if he did knock that one straight into the water, too. And the 86-year-old former leader of the free world began to jump up and down, screaming fuck as loud as he could scream. Over and over again, up, fuck, down, fuck, up, fuck, down, fuck. It was like some crazy exercise routine. I'd never seen anything like it on a golf course, and haven't since. I'll never forget it as long as I live. I had a lot of fun on the golf course with Jerry Ford, but he could be introspective too, especially in those later years. That was when I really learned a lot from him about the House of Representatives as a body, and how all the different committees and caucuses and offices worked together as part of a whole. Ford had a deep love for the House. He used to tell me, a bit sadly, that all he ever wanted to be was Speaker. When I made it to that office, I often thought about Jerry and try to follow what he taught me. I know I did my best to take care of the institution of the House, like he would have wanted. I just wish he'd lived a few more years, because I would love to have shown him into the Speaker's office that he had had his eye on for so long. I know for certain that if history had turned out differently, Speaker Gerald R. Ford would have been one of the finest men to hold the office. But while I couldn't give Ford a tour of the Capitol as Speaker, I could welcome him there in spirit. I still have one of his White House ashtrays in my office. And in 2011, a statue of President Ford was unveiled in the Capitol Rotunda, an event I was proud to preside over as Speaker. That night, after the ceremony, former Ford staff and family members gathered for a reunion dinner in the adjacent Statuary Hall. I had some other event to go to and couldn't make the whole thing, but I stopped by long enough to tell the family the story of Jerry sinking 3 balls in a row into the water at Morningside and going apeshit. I cleaned it up for them, barely. Still, they roared with laughter. 2 Midwestern football players with the same name. One devoted his whole life to the game and teaching and molding the young men who play it. One wanted to be Speaker of the House, but ended up becoming President of the United States. One helped me grow from a kid into a young man who knew to put his team before himself, and God before everything else. One helped me gain a deeper understanding of the House of Representatives, an institution we both loved. I was very lucky to meet Jerry Faust and Jerry Ford at the times of my life that I did. If it weren't for the discipline of Jerry Faust's football team, who knows what sort of bullshit I would have got up to in high school. If I hadn't learned Jerry Ford's wisdom about the House early on in my career there, I might have spent a few terms as a bomb-throwing, Meadows, Mulvaney-type jackass before burning out and going home. Thinking about either of those alternatives is enough to make me sick. Some people knock Jerry Faust for not doing so great as Notre Dame's coach. Some people knock Jerry Ford for losing his election to then-unknown Jimmy Carter. Bullshit. A good man is a good man, Teddy Roosevelt famously said in 1910. It's not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood. Anybody who's actually been in the arena can tell you that a good man is worth a hell of a lot more than points on a scoreboard or an electoral tally. Faust and Ford are two good men I've been very lucky to know. There was one time when the lessons of those two men came together for me, at a moment when I needed it most. In 2006, I ran in the House leadership election to become the majority leader. The former leader, Tom DeLay, had stepped down a few months earlier after getting into some campaign finance trouble. Representative Roy Blunt of Missouri filled in as acting leader and was running against me to gain the position for himself. Representative John Shadegg of Arizona rounded out the field. It was a close race, and naturally I was nervous. But the night before the election, my buddy Tim McCone, who worked for AT&T, called and invited me to go to the 7 a.m. Mass with him at St. Peter's Church on Capitol Hill. Well, that was just what I needed. So the next day, a cold February morning, Tim and I went to the early Mass and then had breakfast at one of my favorite spots, Pete's Diner, just a short walk away. As we walked out of Pete's, my cell phone rang, with a call coming from a number I didn't know. For some reason, I picked up. On the other end of the line was Coach Faust, who gave me a classic pep talk from our days on the field together about stepping up when the team needs you, keeping your head in the game. So I just stood there, listening to this great man, standing in the cold on the sidewalk in front of Pete's Diner, crying my eyes out. I've never gotten a phone call from God, at least not yet. But that was about as close as I'll ever get. And later that morning, my colleagues chose me as their majority leader. I can credit the race to both of these men. Jerry Ford's love for the House helped convince me to stick with the leadership, and Jerry Faust's encouragement helped give me the confidence to be an effective, helpful leader. God has a way of bringing the right people into your life at the right time. You can learn something from pretty much everybody you meet if you learn how to listen. I'm grateful to have been able to learn from guys like Jerry Ford and Jerry Faust. What they taught me was what helped keep me from leaping off the speaker's balcony when it looked like things were spinning out of control. And God knows in Washington, especially once I became speaker, I found myself in that situation pretty regularly.